This is Caught in the Middle, Helping Children Cope with Divorce. It is the OU Parenting Workshops. It is Sunday, December 2nd, and we are talking about how children can get through a divorce amicably. Parents can get through a divorce amicably so that children will not suffer as much as they are or should or will or do. Yeah. Anybody? Anybody for anything else? So we are in the middle of this. I'm so sorry, but we're in the middle of this. Okay, one of the rabbis spoke about developing what's called a management plan, and a protocol and management plan, which I thought was really fabulous, if this could happen. So what he said was that every single year, at the beginning of the year, within the yeshiva, school, so girls' school, boys' school, the principal of the school and the teacher, the Rebbe teacher of that particular child who's going through a divorce, parents are divorced already, whatever it is, they should sit down and have a talk about that child. And that should include everything about the child, whether their cognitive level, their emotional state, what they're up to, their age, what type of family, what type of situation. So hopefully they will know that kind of information, and because their teacher and principal in the school, they'll have some sort of information. And they'll say, you know what, this is what we really want to see, how this child should kind of get through the year and the types of ideas they want to see established for this child, the goals. And then what they should do is they should call up the rabbi of the shul that this child's parents either were, or maybe the father's still there, maybe the mother's still there, depending, or both rabbis, depending on where the parents are, two rabbis if they have to, and talk about the child in context of what they have learned about the child. I guess they might not do it at the very beginning of the year. Maybe they would get to know the child a little bit. And then they would have like a conference, a call or a conference meeting where they would talk about the child and they would talk about what this child needs, what this mother needs. This is a mother who might have younger children, who's taking this child to shul on Shabbos, who is making sure that the mother maybe is invited for lunches, you know, to get to go places. There are some women who have a very wonderful support system. Not all women have support systems. I've been in situations across the board. This has nothing to do with Hasidish, Litvish, Syrian, across the board. I've had young women who've come to me in private practice who have said to me, I can't go home. My parents won't take me in. You're on your own. If you get divorced, you're on your own. And I've had other situations where the parents open arms and welcome the child back and said, don't worry, we'll support you, we're behind you. And it goes everything from there in between. So not every situation is the same. There are some situations where you get a lot of support from the family, and there are some situations where you don't. So I think it's important for the school to know that, for the rabbi of the shul to know that, so that they can give support to the children and give support to the families. And so this would be like a protocol or management plan. So I thought that was like really kind of cool. I did speak to one of the rabbis who said to me, he goes, well, I do that all the time. I'm on the phone with the principals of yeshivas all the time trying to get them to really kind of coordinate just kind of help. Not only if you help the parents, you help the child, because if you're supportive to the parents, then ultimately the parents have more emotional strength, and then they're just better parents. And the better the parents are, the calmer they are, the less stress-free they are, and so on, the better they will parent. Okay. Rabbis are often caught in the crossfire of divorce, kal vachomer the children. Rabbis need to maintain neutrality. Rabbis need to hear both sides, but need to say to the parents that this is not about who is right or who is wrong. This is about what's best for the children. A lot of the rabbis said to me, he says, I tell parents, you may have gotten divorced, but your parenting you'll never be divorced of your parenting. And you have to make it work. Do whatever you have to do. He says, I tell parents that even after parents get a get, in no way is there a get of the parenting. You have to do whatever you have to do to make it work. Okay, and they have to create an environment. The rabbis have to create an environment. Okay, so let me just kind of skip some of this. One thing that one of the rabbanim did say, there will be times when a parent is being very difficult and uncooperative and the other spouse and children are suffering greatly. Because, you know, for the most part, everybody has their perspective. Everyone has their side. So the woman has her perspective, the husband, the father, the man has their perspective. But there are times when it's really a pretty black and white, right or wrong situation. Like, it's not just, well, you know, I'm this way and you know, I'm terrible and he's great, or he's terrible and I'm great, whatever. There are different times where it's a little bit more clear cut, and then rabbis do need to step up and say that this is not acceptable. This is, you know, a man who behaves this way to a wife will not get the aliyah in shul, no matter how wealthy he is, and things of that nature. So these are big steps for Rabbanim to take, but they should be done. Okay. Anger. Primary emotion parents may experience is anger. They may cause each other legal pain. They may try to destroy their ex-spouse's relationship with their child. Both of you created your child. Consequently, inflicting emotional pain on the ex-spouse is also inflicting pain on the child. So what we really recommend to parents is that they really try to find ways to help themselves. I always give the example of when you're on an airplane and the flight attendant does all the instructions, all the safety instructions, and, you know, they talk about those yellow masks that come down and you put them over your face and breathe normally and all that. And they always say the same thing. They always say, if you are traveling with a small child or someone else, please don't forget to put it on your face first and then take care of your child or the person sitting next to you. And the whole idea is you can't take care of anybody else unless you take care of yourself. You must be able to take care of yourself. This goes for mothers and fathers. There are many ways that a parent can take care of themselves and try. There's a lot of, you know, supportive family and friends. We recommend therapeutic support groups. I love Sister to Sister. I think it's a great organization. Sister to Sister will only, and I have the reference, the resource in the back. I have resources in the back. Sister to Sister will only take women. It's for women, obviously, and it's only for women who have their get. They will not accept, like I tried referring a patient who didn't have her get yet, and they didn't want to take her, and they said, because they had gotten a lot of flack from the rabbanim, from the rabbis, that, oh, you're promoting divorce. Look, they're already taking them in. They don't even have their get yet, and you're already taking them in. So they made kind of a deal, an understanding with the rabbis, that they only take in these, you know, they only kind of help and provide resources for the women if they already have a get. But so therapeutic support groups, individual therapy. There are many ways to get therapy. If you can afford private therapy, that's lovely. If you can't, places like Ohel, you know, Tikva, we have a Beach 9th clinic, Jewish Board, Faye Wilbur's place. There are plenty of places out there that can really give, that really have, we have a lot of people at this point at Tikva that are really quite expert in dealing with both the parents and with the children of divorce, because we've kind of cultivated that, because it's a bit like a pet, you know.
Can I ask you a question? So
sure.
Why would somebody want to go private if you claim that all these organizations?
Because
private a lot better?
Private is, I think, a little bit more private. So, for example, if you go into a clinic, if you go into Tikva, which is on King's Highway and Nostrand Avenue, it's a beautiful clinic. It really is, I have to say so myself. But it's a common waiting room, and it's just not, you don't, I think, between a clinic and between a private practice setting, you might not get the same 100% TLC that you get when you're in a private practice setting.
Excuse me, it's the same thing as going to a doctor. If you want to have, you know, you give your birth. You can either go to the clinic and whoever's there is taking care of you.
But you know what you're getting if you go into a clinic, don't you? Can you have your preference?
Basically, the way it's done when you go to a clinic, or certainly the way I ran the clinic, is that you you come in and you have an intake. And you're, depending on what the issue is, you say, why am I here? And so on and so forth. You come for an intake. And then they will assign to you, based on what you're looking for. So I'm looking for a female, I have this insurance, I can come this time, and this is my issue. I'm depressed, I'm anxious, divorced, whatever it is. And then we usually try to we're pretty good at making shidduchim. I can only speak for Tikva pretty much, because I really don't know 100% the staff at other clinics. But at Tikva, there are many therapists at Tikva who have private practices. And sometimes they end up seeing patients at the clinic because the people hear about them, say, oh, I want to come to you, and say, well, you know, if you come to me, you can't afford me, let's say, privately, but if you can come get me at the clinic. And sometimes they can get them at the clinic, and sometimes they can't, because they only have so many hours in the day and they only have so many slots. So I guess that's a difference. It's not even so much that there aren't good people at the clinics. It's just that their time is, if you think about just your N equal, so your population, you're going to have, let's say, we're assuming many more people coming to the clinic setting than coming to the private practice setting, so you're just not going to have enough people to
but
go around.
But more qualified people on the staff in the clinics, then if you can't get A, you get B and C, and they're also...
That's fine, and we try to do that. I think also the difference is, you know, in terms of privacy, in terms of possibly in terms of like doing the callbacks or being more responsive, because you just, when you're in private practice with a patient, it's a little bit of a different, it's not that it's not a good relationship in a clinic, because I know running the clinic for 25 years, the therapists are, I never saw patients at the clinic, because that was my philosophy. I was too busy being the director, so my philosophy was I never see patients at the clinic. I only see patients in my practice. But I supervised all these therapists all these years, and they were very, very devoted. Now, are some of them as experienced as somebody in private practice? No, because many of them come from school, and we take them in as actually interns, and we actually ask the more gifted interns. We don't ask every intern to stay on. No, we don't. We're pretty picky. But if you're a gifted intern, we may ask you to stay. And then if we ask you to stay, obviously it's under very, very strict supervision. But we're talking about people doing work who maybe have 1 year, 2 year, 5 years experience, as opposed to somebody in private practice that has 20 years experience.
Right.
So I'm in private practice for 27 years. I mean, it would be presumptuous for a social worker who's out of school 5 years to say, "Oh yes, it has nothing to do with me. It's just a matter of experience."
Right.
It's not to do with me, Hindi Klein. It's about anybody who's in private practice for 27 years.
These interns, they're specializing in divorce, or they're just
it depends. It depends. What we do at the clinic. Let's say we have interns or new therapists who say, "This is my interest. I'm interested in domestic violence. I'm interested in child abuse. I'm interested in divorce." So what we do is we try to hook them up with supervisors who are specialists in that area. So they're seeing patients, but they're being supervised by people who are family marital people, you know, who are specialists in divorce, child abuse, domestic violence, stuff like that. Esther Katz, you mentioned Esther Katz. So Esther Katz works for OHEL. Her specialty is domestic violence. And domestic violence and other working with children and so on and so forth, and families and moms going through divorce and stuff like that.
So she's a
specialist in this area. And we have a whole program within TICFA that she works with her therapists in TICFA, and she has about five or six therapists under her. Mm-hmm. And those therapists are assigned either the domestic violence or heavy-duty divorce cases, and she supervises them. So it's not like seeing Esther Katz, but it's as close as possible just to seeing Esther Katz. So, okay, I want to just go on because I want to have time for, and I'll be more than happy for a lot of questions. I just want to get through this, and it's important. Okay, so I'll list them. Coping methods for parents, family and friends, supportive groups, individual counseling, relaxation time. You got to relax. Got to find time for yourself. And people who are family and support people really need to help the person find time for themselves. Exercising, eating healthy, keeping a journal sometime is very, very helpful, just to write or to talk to. Okay. So what's the basic concept? Divorce in and of itself is not going to have the terrible impact. It's not going to have the terrible effect. It's a negative reactive behavior of the parents that will have the terrible effect. That, the studies show, is far more harmful than actually that the parents who got divorced. Of course, there's some reaction, but if it's as amicable as possible, the effects will be far worse. If it's amicable, it's far better than if it's not. Okay, now the guilt. Let me just say two words on guilt. Children usually have a lot of guilt. They usually blame themselves. A lot of time they don't understand, especially all the children, even the older children, like what did I do wrong? You know, kids can be very narcissistic. It's all about them. So like, what did I do wrong? If I didn't do well in school, I didn't do this, didn't do that, mommy was annoyed with me, anxious. They right away blame themselves. So this is a very, very, child hears parents arguing about child-related issues. It reinforces their feelings that the divorce is their fault. Here's a quote. Guilt. Please stop fighting and work hard to get along with each other. Try to agree on matters related to me. When you fight about me, I feel like I did something wrong and I feel guilty. I've had children say to me, you know, when I hear something terrible about the other parent, it really hurts me because I am both parents. So I've had a kid say that I'm both parents. I'm my mommy and my tati. I'm both. I'm part of my mommy, I'm part of my tati. So if you say something terrible about my mommy, you say something terrible about me. If you say something terrible about my tati, you say something terrible about me. And the parents, you know, because they get upset, they will say things sometimes and they don't realize that they are cutting to the core of the child's sense of who they are. You know, children develop over the years their sense of self. You say something really negative about the other parent, you are, and this, by the way, goes in marriage too. this goes to marriage too. So a family, a pair, you know, couples who are fighting and say, really, you know, never. I always say when I work with couples, three things: no name calling, no hitting below the belt, saying things that are really nasty, and talk and feeling language, the eye language, the it's not that you're this, you're that. I'm feeling hurt. I'm feeling disappointed. I'm feeling bad because you did this, or this was what was happening. You never attack. You always own your own feelings and talk in feeling language, not name calling and not hitting below the belt. You'll see it'll make a tremendous difference. This, by the way, I just want to recommend this book. This book is Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child. This is by Gottman. Now, Gottman is a marital specialist. He has done years and years of research on couples work. He's amazing. I've gone to many of his workshops, some of his workshops. They're just amazing. He's out in Denver, I think. He's out west somewhere. Seattle? Something like that. He's amazing. But what he did was he got together with the concepts. He took the concepts of Daniel Goleman, G-O-L-E-M-A-N. Daniel Goleman came out with a book a few years ago, called Emotional Intelligence, talking about how children develop their emotional intelligence. And he believes very strongly, he's got a chapter here on divorce, a marriage, divorce, and your child's emotional health. Basically, how to deal with children when you're going through a divorce, because you want to help them do what's emotional coaching. Emotional coaching, just to digress for a moment, when you're doing emotional coaching with a child, to him, what does that mean? 5 points. You become aware of the child's emotion. You become aware of his emotion. You recognize the emotion as an opportunity for intimacy and teaching. Like, I see you're feeling sad. Tell me what's going on. I see you're feeling angry. Tell me what's going on. So you note the emotion, and then you open it up as a conversation piece. And then you say you listen empathically, validating the child's feelings. Not necessarily that you're right away solving their problems. First, you're listening to them and empathizing with their feeling. Help the child find words to label the emotion he is having. Like, you know, it must be sad for you. You must be disappointed. You must be angry about this, that, and the other thing. And then set limits while exploring strategies to solve the problem at hand. It's not just enough about labeling the emotion and saying, oh, gee, I see you're feeling very upset and disappointed. Okay, bye.
What was the fifth point?
Set limits while exploring strategies to solve the problems at hand. You are going to teach your child how to problem solve. That is how you're going to teach them to be emotionally healthier. Because not only are you going to be empathic, you're going to validate, you're going to listen, you're going to name the emotion, you're going to empathize with the emotion, but at the end of the day, you're not going to leave them hanging. You're going to say, okay, so now that you're disappointed about the mommy has to go out to a meeting and I can't stay with you and play Lego, I understand that you're upset and it's sad, you know, when mommy goes away. So acknowledging it, validating. Okay, so what can we do about it? So I really need to go away now. I really do. But let's talk about something that we might be able to do tomorrow together. So maybe tomorrow we're going to go out for ice cream. Maybe that would be okay. Would that be okay?
Is that point number four?
Point number four is help the child find words to label the emotion. So first you become aware of the child's emotion. You recognize the emotion as an opportunity for intimacy and teaching. You listen empathically, validating the child's feelings. You help the child find words to label the emotion, and then you set limits while exploring strategies to solve the problem at hand. You want to help them. This is a really good book. It's easy. It's it's called Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child, The Heart of Parenting. This is John Gottman, PhD. And the foreword is by Daniel Goleman, and Daniel Goleman is the author of Emotional Intelligence. It's a good book. Okay, so I'm going back. If a child hears negative comments about the other parent, they may try to manipulate either or both parents. Like, you know, I'm going to, you know, dad said no, I'll ask mom. Mom says no, I'll ask dad. And this goes back and forth, back and forth. Yaha, you wanted to ask a question? No. Okay, negative responses from the parent results in negative impact on the child. I'll just give you a few quotes. You don't have new shoes for school because your father or mother doesn't pay child support.
What page are you on?
I am page... Oh, no, that's not... I'm reading for my own... You're getting the summary. This is the hand that I didn't give you with all this. Your father or mother has always been irresponsible. If your mother or father loved you so much, he or she would not have divorced me. Subtle insults can be very destructive. For example, facial expressions. You know the eye rolling? Look. Eye rolling? It's just very destructive. It looks so subtle. You say, I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything terrible. But facial expressions, body language could be very, very destructive as well. Okay, research shows that the effects can be academic struggles, higher potential for dropping out of school and for divorcing themselves, depression, low self-esteem. These are, there have been studies done. Judith Wallerstein, actually, she just passed away. She did a 25-year study where she followed children of divorce over 25 years. She's like one of the biggest names. I have some resources in the back of names of books that you can buy. Okay, positive statements. So let me give you an example of a positive statement. Your dad and I made the choice to divorce because we thought it would be best for everyone, and our decision to divorce is not because of you or your behaviors. Straight and to the point. Very simple. This is not rocket science. It really isn't. A lot of the stuff here, when you think about it, is just emotionally healthy common sense. But when we get so caught up in the emotion of the divorce and the pain and the anguish of the divorce, this comment, which seems so easy to make, there's no way I can make this comment, you know, because I just feel so much anger. Both Mom and I love you very much and will always do so. Just because we separated from each other does not mean we will ever separate from you. You can love both of us and never feel that it means choosing between us. The love of a parent has for a child never dies. And children need to see their parents as good people. See, they want to see their parents as good people. If they see their parents as horrible, disgusting, destructive people, again, it seeps into their own sense of who they are. But like, I'm part of this person, so like, what does that say about me? Again, easier said sometimes than done. If parents can be in sync with one another, then it'll be more difficult. See, what happens is the kids are very brilliant. So what happens is they will try to manipulate. They'll see right away, I can get to mother this way, I can get what I want out of mom, because I know that this is whatever that's going on between the two of them, so I'm going to manipulate. Well, mom says I can't have this, but maybe you'll get it for me, so now I'm going to be the best revenge, and I'm going to get you the new pair of sneakers or the new bicycle or whatever it is that the child wants. So the child learns very quickly that they can manipulate, and that they can manipulate one parent over the other, and they can get what they want, which is great, by manipulation. So if the parents are in sync, I've worked with couples who, and this is, again, easier said than done, but I'm thinking about a couple who's divorced already. Oh, I don't even know. They must be divorced. I mean, their oldest child was 14 when they got divorced. Their youngest child was like 4 to 10, like 6. They had 3 children. These kids are all married with children of their own, big families of their own. And they weren't happy about the divorce. They weren't. But one thing they did admit, they never heard either parent say one bad thing about the other parent. Not one. I know that in this particular family, both parents made an oath to each other. They made like a deal. No negative stuff about each other to the children. You want to go have a meeting? Go have a meeting somewhere. You want to talk on the phone? See, nowadays also, that was years ago. So how did you communicate years ago? Phone. Shine, phone.
Send an email, that's the difference.
Nowadays, there are so many ways you can communicate. You don't have to talk to your ex at all. Mm-hmm. You want to send an email, you want to send a text, you want to send a fax. There are, you know, people who don't have email or internet, send a fax on a phone, send whatever it is. There are many, many ways that you can communicate with your ex or soon to be ex, and it doesn't have to be if you really, because there are some people who really say to me, I can't be in the same room with them. I want to do the best by the children. I've had several couples come to me. You know, it depends, I guess, about your population. I've had several couples come to me where they're getting divorced and they want to do what's right by the child. And that's all they care about. That's all they care about. And I think it's amazing. I think it's wonderful. And it's very commendable that this is that this is so important to them, that they want the best for their child. And, you know, they put their own, you know, he goes aside for a minute and they say, okay, then if they really can't speak to one another and they need to get somebody who's a helpful mediator. Here's my opinion. If you have somebody, see, there's two types of mediator. I'm talking about the official mediator, and we'll talk about that in a second, and then there's a mediator, a person who could be maybe a family member, a friend, somebody who's neutral, because in other words, let's say you have somebody who's going to go in between. So if it's more sided for the mother or for the father, then the other parent's not going to listen. So you need to find somebody who both parents respect or listen to. You need to find somebody, whether it's a family member, a friend, a rav, a rabbi, an askin, somebody where both parents will respect this person and both parents will know that the person is working for however way in their best interest. So you can try to find that. I'm the other type of mediator, by the way, because a lot of Rabbanim now are saying, you know what, don't go through the courts. It's devastating. A huge amount of money. It's a waste of money. Who gets rich on this? The lawyers. You know, you've heard all these things. Go through a mediator. Now, I've seen really good mediators, and I've seen not so good mediators. You know, so there are some mediators that are really professional mediators. They go to school for divorce mediation.
Do you have names to get that opinion?
Do they what? Know? I do have, actually, because I have a therapist.
Do they know the law? I don't think they know the law the way the lawyer
knows. No, there are some mediators who are really, really well-meaning, wonderful, wonderful people. Usually they're men. They're wonderful people. They're askanim. They're fine, vile, everything. Lovely. But they're not necessarily good mediators. They're not. And I just went through with somebody a divorce where she really felt that she really got the raw end of the stick. You know, that the mediator was much more quote unquote pro the man, and she really was. She didn't feel that the mediator helped her at all. Helped her. I don't know. I don't know this mediator personally. I just heard a lot about him from the woman, which wasn't all pretty. He's supposedly a well-known mediator, and he's like a very wise, smart man. But I have a therapist, an analyst colleague of mine. She's a PhD level psychologist. She is a psychoanalyst, a certified analyst, and she is also a certified divorce mediator. She went for schooling. I can get you her number. I don't know how long her training was, but she's been doing this for years, and she's really Joy is lovely. I mean, she's not a fun person. Yeah, she's not a fun person, but she's really she. I mean, I don't know if some people will only want to go to a fun man or a fun woman or whatever, but she's not a fun person. Okay, I think they're starting to walk around. I'm going to skip a lot. Parents should develop better coping mechanisms for themselves. You know this, okay? I'm not going to go through resiliency. Okay, so now we're up to the practical steps, and the practical steps are really in this booklet. That's what I photocopied for you. The practical steps of, and if you want to go through them very quickly, assure your child that you want, if you look at the yellow handouts, so that basically talks about the difference. Now, is there any questions that people have? Because this is pretty straightforward. You can read these yourself. If you want to take a quick, just for the sake of time, if anybody wants to take a quick look, instead of me reading them or going over one by one, if you want to look through them quickly, and you might have a question about any of the particular, there's 17 items here. Okay? Some of them are very straightforward. Do not criticize the other parent when your child is present or in front of anyone else. Set the right example for everyone to see. Choose the high road. Don't argue. Work to resolve your own personal emotions by getting the help that you need. You know, obviously it would be fabulous if you could go to a therapist together with your ex for the sake of the children. I know this is like a far-fetched idea for many people. Very far-fetched. I've had that. People come to me that way. So it is doable. It is doable. Okay? You show your child a great deal of love and understanding. If this is not about them, do not use your child as a messenger. Not a messenger, not a manipulator. Do not use your child. It is one of the most destructive things you can do.
Any age.
Go tell mommy this and go tell tati that.
Very quick learners. Before you turn around, they're going to be playing that game against you.
Against you.
Okay.
By the way, a lot of times I've had this question, which is very interesting. I've had somebody ask me, well, what happens, two things I want to say. What happens if the parent, either the mother or the father, really was a horrible abuser, a domestic violence, child abuse, physical, sexual abuse is something else, physical for children, but really not a good person, not a good mother, not a good father, whatever it is. I'm not going to be biased against men. And so it really is true that they really are not a good person. And the child will learn it soon enough. Trust me. They will learn it soon enough by the way the parent acts, whether it's the mother or the father. You have to keep as much as possible on the high road. It's not that you'll never lose it. I think it's very human that you're able to admit that. And I think it's very good that you're able to admit that. It's not that you're never human. It's not that you're not going to lose it. But you try your best to stay on the high road. Trust me when I tell you, as the kids grow up, they will realize which parent is more destructive, because they will see it. And if one parent stays on the high road and the other parent constantly is not, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. Kids are brilliant. They pick things up, nuances, what they hear, what they don't hear, what they see, what they don't see. They pick up body language. They pick up facial expressions. You'd be so surprised what they know at a very young age. 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, they just know. They just know. It's almost like this osmosis. I don't know how they know it, but they just know it. And the older kids, also, you know, another thing I want to say, a lot of times adolescents become like the other parent, because if they're mature, they hide behind maturity. And a lot of times mothers or fathers will use the adolescent daughter or son as a sounding board, as a therapist, as somebody to lean on, because they're the new mommy in the house. They're the new Tati in the house. You should not do that. You can't do that to adolescents. It's too much of a burden, and B, they're going through a lot of their own emotional stuff that they might may keep hidden because I'm the new, you know, daddy now. I'm the new mommy now. So they might not even let out how much they're hurting. So don't assume that just because you have this real, you have an adolescent who's very mature, that you can rely on them as a sounding board. You need a sounding board? Go to a family member, go to a therapist, go to a group, not your adolescent child. A lot of parents do that, and it's really not good. One final other thing. There are times when there is actual abuse. Two things. If there is actual abuse, and I'm talking about physical and or sexual, but even more physical, although physical is terrible, also sexual abuse, then you do have to get the child away from that parent, whether it's a mother or a father. You need to get them away from that parent. And then you will have to go through certain steps to make sure that that parent is not exposed to the child. So that's a much more extreme situation, but that does happen, and you will take that child away from that parent and not expose them. However, what we've come to see lately, and this is devastating for children, is I've seen this several times, that the mother will say that the father is sexually abusing the kids because they want custody. And they figured all you got to do is make that 800 phone call number and call in the father as a sexual predator, sexual abuse, and that's it. In court, they're done. They're getting the kids. The father's never going to look at those kids. They're never going to see the kids again, because now it's on record. All you have to do is have... Anybody can make a... You don't have to prove it in the beginning. In the beginning, you don't have to prove it. Then you go to court. Basically, you have to... The law is if you even suspect any sort of abuse, you have to report it. The lawyers sometimes tell the mothers, do this and you'll get your children. Do this and you'll get your children.
There's no way to prevent it.
And it's very...
Why is anyone making that up?
Some people are making that up because they want their kids.
That's what I'm saying.
They want their kids. So there are times when you're going to have, when it's really true, but when it's not true, don't do it because you think you're getting your kids. It is super destructive to the family system, to the child, especially when nothing happened between them and that parent, and now they're not allowed to see that parent anymore. Because that has happened. Okay. All right. The rest of the stuff is very self-explanatory, pretty much. If you'd like to, but they're nice, commonsensical do's and don'ts. So they're good to refer. They're good to refer to. Do not ask your child whom they love more. This is as ridiculous as asking a non-divorced parents which one of their children they love more. I've seen that also. Don't ask you who you love more now that they're separate. Do not ask your child which parent they want to live with unless the child is a teenager and has the maturity to be part of such a decision. It is the parents, or if necessary, the courts, who decide where the children live, not the children. Do not use your child as a sounding board for your feelings or to fill the role of a friend or a therapist. Sometimes they will need an outside party if they need to speak to a therapist. Toby has obviously done a lot to make sure that her kids are all taken care of. And try to maintain your child's routine as much as possible. Remember that for young children, having a fixed schedule is very important. So just kind of keep them on track. And read about divorce. This is a really nice book. It's not really about divorce. It's called The Invisible String by Patricia Karst. It's a beautiful child's book. And it basically talks about the invisible string of love that parents and children just have. So you should know if you're separated from your mommy or from your daddy, you're always together because you have this invisible string of love. It's a beautiful little book. Patricia Karst, K-A-R-S-T. Patrice Karst, illustrated by Geoff Stevenson. It's a lovely little book. I just got it myself. And this is for you to read with your children. Right. It's not about divorce. It's about love.
Okay.
It's about love and attachment and connection. It's about connection. And it's applicable here because a lot of times when parents get divorced, they're disconnected from one parent or another at any given time. So this talks about how you're always connected by this invisible string, no matter what. So it's really nice. I also have in the in the resources, you'll see the different clinics. I mentioned OHEL, obviously. We have various OHEL clinics. I mentioned Mordechai Newman's book, Helping Your Kids Cope with a Divorce the Sandcastle's Way. Then there's Raising Emotion. Then the other page, last couple of pages are two. I don't know how you have it in your handout. But the last page is The Truth About Children Divorce, Dealing with Emotions So You and Your Child Can Thrive, Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child. That's Gottman's book that I showed you here. And then the landmark study by Wallerstein. And this is another book. These are like books that have been recommended in terms of they're good readings. And read. And talk to your friends. And talk to people around you. And nowadays, thank God, there is more support than there used to be. So much more support. And good luck with everything.
Thank you so much.